This is broadcast number 557, August the 9th, 1982. First, a disclaimer for the station. Everything I say here, I am totally responsible for. The opinions stated on World Watchers are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of KAZU or its staff. That should make it clear. I stand by what I say, and they are not responsible for these names that I mention on the air. Also, I want to remind you that they always need funds. There's always fundraising for the station. This is a listener-sponsored station, and any checks you send in are appreciated. Also, I read in the paper that KKUP is having trouble. That's up at Cupertino. They carry World Watchers another evening up there, and I understand their rent is going up and they may have to go off the air. So for those of you that listen to World Watchers up there, please help support the station. They're going to have a meeting. I don't know how they're going to be able to make it with that $450 a month rent, but help them if you can and come up with ways to go to hearings and see if you can help them to have the station continue for all the programs that are on there, not only for World Watchers. Now, there are two books out. I haven't read either of them. But
one of these books is by Thomas Finley. It's called Famous Last Words. And the other book is by Steve Shagan called The Circle. The Famous Last Words and The Circle. And they're about international plots involving large groups of people in government, organized crime, and in the military working together. I haven't read either one of them yet, but I will get them as soon as possible.
When I get them, or there's talk shows where the authors are on the air and you can call in and talk with them. One is called The Circle by Steve Shagan, S-H-A-G-A-N. I missed him on KGO this last week, but I'll pick him up somewhere else. He wrote the book The Formula. That was the story of I.G. Farben, the Chase Manhattan, the secrecy of the oil problems, the monopoly of oil, and that was a good movie. It didn't get too much attention, but it was an interesting movie and a good book. Now he's come out with a book called The Circle, and he describes the characters in this book as what are seemingly unconnected events and people in the news. I'm reading a book review from the San Francisco Chronicle. This may be a disclaimer of a sort for the publisher, because both of these presidents are very much part of this inner circle and have to know about these things because they are the leader of the country that is manipulating these particular agencies and persons. But in the book, The Circle, they go into clandestine meetings underneath the White House in what is like the war room, where assassinations are plotted, where they shift to mafia meetings in Mexico, Las Vegas, and Sicily. You see Paul Laxalt, Senator Laxalt, run as manager of Ronald Reagan's campaign and has a long history in Nevada, the Vegas connections there to the President of the United States. This author says all of this is linked and attempts to tell a story of these various characters of the mafia, the Korean Gate, again, Henry Kissinger, and various presidents of the United States and the plans for murders, narcotics, traffic, and so forth. The review of the book said Shagan shows his intention to expose, and this is the important thing, in quotes, the permanent, faceless, non-elected government in Washington and other countries that through their manipulation of elected officials and their partnership with the underworld and big business and their secret buildup of military armaments and nuclear weaponry are leading us to the edge of extermination. Now, again, there's a disclaimer in the review, I guess, by the author. He says it's not by design, but by accident and mismanagement. And what I've tried to show through my years of research, and I just hit upon these interconnecting webs when I studied and began to find out who killed John Kennedy, I came up with the same cast of characters that are in this particular book, The Circle. I think that these events are planned, and the two words that are left out of the review are coup d'etat and assassinations. He says through the non-elected government officials and faceless people in Washington. The leaders of our country are there because when the elected officials don't suit the ruling clique that are manipulating behind the scenes and in the basement of the White House, they can be murdered, such as John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy, or Adlai Stevenson, or they could get rid of Hubert Humphrey and poison or give cancer or cause accidents to happen, to get rid of anybody that doesn't fit in to the overall design and plan. I will read the book, but this author is around lecturing around the country, and if you can hear him, Steve Shagan, The Circle. Now, the other book along the same lines is a rave review. It was reviewed in the New York Times and also in the San Francisco Examiner. It's called Famous Last Words by Timothy Findlay. And this book review says, make room on your bookshelf. This is similar to Catch-22, Gravity's Rainbow, and so forth. Famous Last Words is the story of the history of the world the way it should be. And according to this book reviewer, they said this book isn't for anybody who is satisfied with William Shire's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Intimating, as I have said for a long, long time, that these kind of books, and the book by Mr. Tolan called Adolf Hitler, are fiction. They're not the true way that history came down. Now, this author claims that there's a clique that began in 1924, or at least the review says, up through the Nuremberg trial and on beyond that, a clique of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, Mussolini, Mussolini's relatives, Count Ciano, Charles Lindbergh, von Ribbentrop, a political group that plotted to impose a political and social order of their own taste. Now, this also is true. There was a group in Great Britain and in Italy, basically the monarchy, that were displaced, the fear of the revolution in Russia taking over, taking away their thrones. The ruling clique got together and set up a system whereby they could topple other governments and set up a network mainly behind the corporation of IG Farben in Europe, America, South America. And when the war was over, they continued the kind of intent they had, and I use expression, to make the world safe for feudalism. And this book is the story of what happens to history when wars are over. The review says that the first casualty of a war is truth. What history we are allowed to have is an officially approved history, the victor's history. The losers are not welcome to browse through the victor's foreign ministry in order to make their case. I give the example of after John Kennedy was murdered, the information, a lot of the information was locked up for our lifetime in the National Archives, and when the second investigation was begun several years ago, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, more information was locked up for 50 years. And researchers who worked with the House Select Committee had to swear to secrecy, never to relay what they heard or saw, what was covered up, and so forth. So there are now two books, Famous Last Words by Timothy Findlay and The Circle by Shagan, and those two books are incorporating the historic overview, the history of the world the way it really is, the way it is manipulated behind the scenes and not so much behind the scenes. The important thing is that if you read the paper every day, and if you read the books that are published and follow the news, these people that are doing the manipulating are more visible every day, or we're more conscious of them. And those are the people that I try to talk about on these broadcasts and call attention to not only what's happening to them, but what they are doing to us. And by us, I mean the planet Earth. Now, in another week or two, I'm going to go into some more detail about some serious murders and corporate struggles taking place right now. Some very important articles have come out in the last few weeks. But when the upper echelon begins killing each other, you have to be more careful. They go after us and they go after labor unions. But now there is a large series. There are a series of people being murdered, the multimillionaire class struggling at the top to get to that top poll or to cut off information that people shouldn't have. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal this last week, July 20th, 1982. Change of fortune, a proxy battle builds up. And this is the battle between Bear Stearns Group and Global Natural Resources. Now, I'll do more on that later, but before they get into the article, the Wall Street Journal, they make note that they said to add a morbid note to the forthcoming clash of proxy and stockholders, the company director
who controlled the largest single block of the company's stock, that was 1.2 million shares, fell to his death from a New York hotel window April the 16th, 1982. That man was Erskine Carter from Toronto, a lawyer. I didn't clip the articles at the time. I don't even remember seeing it. He had 1.2 million shares of World Resources. Now, that one article from the Wall Street Journal brings in the who's who of the last era, many important names. The Warburg Bank in Germany, the M.M. Warburg, Brinkman, Wirtz & Company German Bank, Frank Beatty from Summit, New Jersey, Robert Vesco, Bernie Kornfield, the Global Resources Corporation, James Ling from Texas, the Texas International Instruments, Arm & Hammer, Occidental Petroleum. This is a battle for the entire oil and energy of the Canadian Arctic. And the battle became exposed when the attorney with the large block of stocks flew out the window in New York City, and the 1.2 million shares, the voting proxy cards, went to the Bernie Kornfield gang as opposing the New Jersey Robert Vesco. That's the old investment overseas fighting each other at the highest corporate levels. Now, I will do more on the airplane crash of Charter Oil. The president of Charter Oil, the vice president, the senior vice president, went down a helicopter over Ireland. Again, this involves Robert Vesco, Billy Carter, Libya, and Armand Hammer, the common denominator again through this case. And, of course, the unsolved murder of the former chairman of Lockheed and his wife and the housekeeper in Pennsylvania, the murder of Roberta Calvi, the president of the Banco Ambrosiano that began four London banks and 250 world banks to be trembling and shaking. And then Jocelyn Cadbury, a multimillionaire in London, was shot last week, August the 2nd. And he's a member of parliament. He comes from the Schweppes family and Candy family. Very conservative. He disagreed with Margaret Thatcher's policies, and he was shot outside his home. And then the body of a multimillionaire, Peter Richmond, the textile tycoon, was found off Long Island with two anchors and a gun tied to his side. He's disappeared in November. So that besides the secretary, Roberto Calvi, you have the murder of the Toronto lawyer with all the shares to World Resources, the voting proxy cards, the four the executives of Charter Oil, the former head of Lockheed, Roberto Calvi, the president of a bank in Italy, a multimillionaire in London, and a textile tycoon in New England from Stamford, Connecticut. And there are common denominators running through these, so we have to watch these, and I'll do more on them later, but they really take a lot of time by themselves, and there's other stories I want to get caught up and not lose track of, because I've been doing so much about the Italian banks and the effect that they will have on American banks later. I know they will have. I do want to update you every week. We're doing an update on the Fritz Kramer story, Kramer versus Kramer. Many of you listeners are too young to remember the Rin Tin Tin movies. When we were young, we went to the movie on Saturday, and there was a scene where the movie left off, and you had to go back the next week to pick it up. It was an ongoing series. Well, I have to update you on Kramer versus Kramer. 2 weeks ago, I read to you a letter I got from Palestine from the Archive Center that they had no information concerning Hitler's chief of staff, Fritz Kramer. When World War II was over, they said they had no information on Hitler's chief of staff, Fritz Kramer, even though he was a prisoner at the Dachau trials. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He got off with the help of American lawyers and Senator Joe McCarthy and the Georgetown group. He took a disappearance and hasn't been seen in any history books since that date. 2 weeks ago, I talked about him. Last week, I mentioned a letter I got from the Army Intelligence and Security Command wanting to, I asked them for information about our American Fritz Kramer, the German who recruited Henry Kissinger and took him to the Battle of the Bulge, and was 40 years old. He had several doctor's degrees, one from Germany, one from Italy. Well, this week I got a letter from the Defense Investigative Service. It was a restricted delivery. I had to go to the post office and sign it. It was a return receipt request, and it was certified. It was a triple letter from the Defense Investigative Service saying that they were giving me certain information that I asked about F.G. Kramer, my request, and other information. Some was withheld, and some more would come later out of St. Louis, Missouri. They couldn't answer my questions. The first page they sent was completely blank. It had the name Kramer, Fritz Gustav Anton Kramer, and he was inducted into the United States Army May 21st, 1943. This is the fellow whose wife and baby are living with his parents in Nazi Germany. It is the height of the war, 1943. In January, Hitler was retrenching and ready to go underground, and by May, this German Kramer was inducted into the United States Army. And 1 month later, he was put into Army intelligence. He was sent to Camp Lee, Virginia, Camp Ritchie, Maryland, and then he recruited Henry Kissinger at Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. Now, the third page of Fritz Gustav Anton Kramer is an interesting story that does not answer my question, and I have written and asked for some more details, but it gives you a pretty good picture of Mr. Kramer. From 20 September 1944, now that is just 2 months before the Battle of the Bulge. It was at the time of the Arnhem Battle, the betrayal at Arnhem, where double agents were giving information to the American and Dutch, were being slaughtered there, and the Germans went on through Arnhem. And this is when Henry Kissinger was taken to Europe with Fritz Gustav Anton Kramer. From 20th September 1944 to 18 April 1945. Now, that the war was over May 8th, 1945. So this is 3 weeks before the war was over. Private Kramer, Fritz Kramer, served in 7 countries. This may be as a shocker to you. He was in Scotland. He was in the United States. He was Scotland. He was England. He was in France. He was in Belgium. He was in Holland, and he was in Germany. So when the war was over, he could be in Germany, where he was picked up for that quick trial at Dachau. He was in Germany at the end of the war. Now, he was in the 84th Infantry Division, and he was a battle clerk. He was temporarily given a second lieutenant appointment, temporarily, in April of 45. And in 1948, this is when the other Kramer is beginning in the War Department and the National Security Council of the United States, the subject was appointed a first lieutenant and went to inactive status. Now, I wrote back following this letter asking for the exact dates that he entered these particular countries and when he left them. When did he go to Scotland? When did he leave it? When did he go to England? And so forth. I'm not sure how many privates went to 7 countries at the height of the war from September 1944 until April 1945. Now, Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's chief of intelligence, was working with Alan Dulles in April of 1945, getting ready to come to the United States to turn the OSS into the CIA, which I said became the American Gestapo. And you'll see more of that in the next months and years to come as they begin to tighten the vise. But this particular fellow was in 7 different countries, and so I want to know more. They did send me another sheet on Fritz Gustav Anton Kramer, and most of it was blank pages, 2 blank pages, just that he went in the Army in May 43 and was transferred to military intelligence of June 43, and by 1944 was in 7 countries. So I'll be getting more from St. Louis, Missouri. I got another letter saying that they were still looking up the information on the dates of where he was, and hopefully by next week I'll have that for you. Now, in the Executive Intelligence Review, a magazine that's put out, they are always hammering at Fritz Kramer. They were the first publications to call attention to this person, and there's a long article just this last issue, June the 1st, 1982. Henry Kissinger boasts of 3 decades of treason. And again, this issue goes into the fact that Henry Kissinger was drafted in the Army in 1943 in the Armed Forces, and he was soon adopted by Fritz Kramer, a supporter of the pro-fascist pan-European Union of the Venetian Habsburgs. And he belonged to the counts and the royal families of Venice. Those were the black oligarchy, those were the royalty that formed the international fascist leagues that are so far right that the very conservatives look like they're left. He was picked up, Henry Kissinger was adopted by this particular group, and Kissinger and Kramer took him to Europe. Well, for Kramer to be in American uniform as a private, traveling to all these countries and putting Henry Kissinger right there in Europe when the war was over. This article on Kissinger says that he got a job as a driver interpreter for a general in the intelligence division where Kramer was an officer. Now, Kramer wasn't, he was temporarily, he was a private, but the Army says he was just given a temporary officer's uniform. So the truth is that he really wasn't an American officer at all. He was dressed as one, and when they got him out of the Army, they gave him an officer's commission. When he was severed out of the Army, it wasn't as an officer. He was a private at the time. And then this Executive Intelligence Review reminds people, the readers, of Kissinger's treason as the Butcher of Chile. He ousted the Allende government in 1973 and set up the entire Latin American as well as the Southeast Asian genocidal policies. If any of you saw the movie Missing, there's a very sad scene almost at the end when the coffin of Charles Horman is coming home, and Horman, and there is a mention in there of Kissinger and of Nazis. And that's why I keep corresponding and trying to find out if that Fritz Kramer in the disguise was Hitler's Fritz Kramer, because they were meeting with the same people as soon as the war was over and ever since the war was over. Now, I mentioned on the broadcast several weeks ago, for the last two or three weeks, July the 12th, 2 weeks ago, that Muhammad Aja, the fellow that shot at the Pope, who had assistance, was helping tell who shot the Pope with him. He was beginning to talk about the involvement of the conspiracy. Over there in Europe, they recognize conspiracies. In the United States, we still have the lone assassin. July the 12th, Aja, according to the Los Angeles Herald Examiner and other news stories, was beginning to tell who helped him with a plot to shoot the Pope. And a week later, July 26th, I mentioned that there was an article in a magazine called Eagle Times linking the men who shot the Pope, Aja, and his co-workers to the organization Permandex, the same people that were behind the murder of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and many other people. Well, this week, the Los Angeles Times has an article, "Rebel French Prelate Seeks Reconciliation with the Pope." The radical Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, L-E-F-E-B-V-R-E, the fellow mentioned in publications and that I've had on the air, who was behind the Spanish priest who attempted to murder John Paul II, again with a bayonet, that was May the 12th, just a few months ago. This fellow was that tried to kill the Pope in Portugal, was a protege of the Bishop Lefebvre of France. This bishop is much further right than John Paul II, again, if that's possible, and he has resigned this last week from the leadership of his far-right group. The prelate, Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, has resigned from his organization because now that the discussion of his role in ordaining the man and training the man who tried to stab the Pope in May is out, and Aja is talking about the other shooting attempt, he's come for reconciliation with the Pope. He's come to apologize. He stepped down from his organization. It's called the Society of Priests, and he's against the heresy of modernism. He thinks that the Catholic Church is too modern, and he had ordained and trained and worked with the fellow that tried the last stabbing and also with Aja. It's a far right-wing Nazi group trained by the werewolves, Hitler's youth, the same group that have worked with Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig, that inner circle of the very vicious assassination team. The French prelate has gone for reconciliation. He stepped down, and he has wanted to see the Pope this week and apologize. If he stepped down, somebody else stepped up. This week, many of you may have seen a big promotion for Ronald Reagan's secretary. President Reagan announced in Des Moines, Iowa, that he will promote Helene Von Dahm to be the president's personal representative in the White House. She will replace E. Pendleton James, and she gets a high appointment with Ronald Reagan. Now, this woman came from Austria. She worked with the Reinhardt-Gehlen operation. She worked with Otto von Bolschwing, who was Adolf Eichmann's superior. She married a man named Von Dahm, who's a banker in Europe. She's now married to a fellow in New Jersey. Helene Von Dahm came to California in 1976. When Reagan became the governor, she sat for 4 years next to him and reinforced the Nazification policies throughout this state. Now she was placed in the Sacramento offices by von Bolschwing through the organization TCI. And when Reagan went on to Washington, she had the room next to the Oval Office. Now she's going to get a big salary and be right in the White House. And one of her jobs is to pacify the Jewish organizations. There was an article in the Los Angeles Times in 1981, Helene Von Dahm, Someone Special, and it tells about her life in Austria and how she came to the United States. She married Christian Von Dahm, a German international banker, in 1970 and divorced him in 1978. It would be interesting and mandatory to know, and I'm going to write to the White House this week, and I'll give you the answer on the air when I get it. What bank does her husband work for in Germany, Christian Von Dahm in Germany? And is it linked to the global resources story that I'm going to do for you probably next week, that Wall Street Journal, that shocking story of German banks and the Canadian Arctic Circle and the resources of the Northern Arctic? This month, Von Dahm married a fellow who's helping her now with the Jewish question, and she's trying to placate the Jews going around campaigning in New Jersey. This is identical to Adolf Eichmann and learning Hebrew and studying Herzl and going to Palestine and off von Bolschwing, going to Israel and being kicked out as a Nazi spy in 1936 and then going up to Holland. Von Dahm's role, one of her roles, is to work with the Jewish community, and her husband, she says, her new husband is working very hard to get support for the Jewish community. Her target is the Jewish community, and yet she comes in right through Hitler's chief of intelligence of the Eastern Division, Adolf Eichmann. So she's a woman to watch because she's now been promoted to a very high salary and position. Now, one more story before we take the break on the hour. New York Times has an article, Political Shift Illustrated by Moderate Departure. This is Leslie Gelb. And he uses the example of Bobby Inman, Admiral Bobby Inman, leaving the CIA as deputy director, Alexander Haig leaving the State Department, and General Jones leaving the Pentagon. Now, Inman left the CIA because Edwin Wilson came home, and if Inman were to stay in there and the House Committee of Intelligence were to investigate Edwin Wilson, which I doubt they can ever really do, and Frank Turple and George Corcoran, he headed Task Force 157, worked with Henry Kissinger in the murder of Allende, worked with George Bush when he was director of the CIA, headed the assassination teams. The reason Inman stepped down isn't because the moderates are departing. He's now working with the House Intelligence Committee, the Fox, guarding that house as information comes in about Edwin Wilson to see what comes in, and also in case he gets tangled in any of the witnesses talking, he has to be out of office. And Alexander Haig stepped out because of the role with Licio Gelli, with Roberta Calvi, with NATO, with the plans for fascism in Italy. They didn't step down as moderates, and the New York Times is trying to give them the role as being moderate people in the administration when there's nobody further right than Bobby Inman and Alexander Haig. We'll take a break now, and I'll be back with you in 1 minute. This is Mae Brussel at KAZU-FM.